Let me catch up to where we were, which is we talked about Lorentz transformations, and now I want to move on. So I want to move to, this is a section which is on complex variable techniques, but you've noticed it's not always on complex variables techniques. And, for example, Lorentz transformations had little to do with it. I want to move back and actually do more Fourier analysis. So which Fourier analysis? I got a little stuck there. Which Fourier analysis? I want to talk about Paley-Wiener theory. So at first glance, this is a subject in complex variables and has nothing to do with PDE. Everyone agree? Nobody knows. Who's seen Paley-Wiener theory before? Postdocs aren't allowed to, you know, faculty members are not allowed to raise their hands. Yeah, I'm glad I'm talking about the right thing then. It is a subject in complex variables, and I'm going to make it a subject in several complex variables. And we'll see that it will have to do with PDE and the wave equation. So let's say some things which are self-evident first. So the functions. Well, the ones we see in complex analysis all the time are e to the minus I c dot x. And x is an Rn, but think of that for a moment as a parameter. So c is an Rn. X is an Rn. It's sort of a little bit of an aside for the moment. And I want to say that it's pretty clear that this is the restriction to the real axis, but I mean it's an n-dimensional thing, so the real hyperspace of a function of complex variables. It's a restriction to Rn c of a function of zeta, which is c plus I eta, which is on all of cn. In particular, the function e to the minus I zeta dot x, right? And it's a little bit more specific than just saying it's a function of complex variables. One, it's holomorphic. And so the big comment is this is holomorphic. And if anyone wants to know what holomorphic means, it means analytic. Somehow, in several complex variables, or if you're trying to make your results sound especially fancy, you say they're holomorphic rather than analytic. But it means the same thing, just usage of words. So, but I want to say a little bit more than that, and that's going to be in my definition one, which is. Which will pertain to this function in particular, but I want to talk to about a general class. So an entire function g of zeta is, now first, a function which is entire means holomorphic on all of cn. And so entire means this. So that's IE. Entire. So an entire function, and this is even more than just a typical entire function. So an entire function g of zeta is called, what I want to say, is called, well, let me say it this way, is, quote, of exponential type when it does the following thing. When it admits estimates that the size of g zeta is not bigger than a constant e to the r, the imaginary part of zeta. And I also want it to decay, much like the Schwartz class. So I'm going to say that I even want 1 plus zeta to the nth power times g, but this constant might depend on n. And I want this to be for all n. Okay? What does that imply about the behavior of g on the real axis? This implies that it's bounded, and this implies that it decays rapidly. Okay? On the imaginary direction, that's more, it says more. Because, of course, a function can't decay rapidly in all directions and still be holomorphic. But it says that its growth is limited to e to a constant size times the imaginary part. Let me think for a second. A definition, an entire function g is of exponential type when there exists a constant r such that this holds. That's shorthand notation for that statement. So, examples. Well, one was e to the minus I zeta dot x. Is it of exponential type? Unfortunately, it was until I put this weight factor in. Then it didn't become anymore. So it's no, because as a second thought, I put in the weighted behavior. But how does this imaginary part grow? Well, let's no because of weights. But let's still notice that the size of e to the minus I zeta dot x is, of course, the same thing as the phase is the real part, and so it's going to be equal to the e to the size of imaginary part of zeta dot zeta, and x is real, so like an imaginary part of zeta dot x. Right, which is bounded by e to the imaginary part of zeta times x. And so this at least has the exponent behaving like r is equal to x. R is equal to the length of x. So it's not of exponential type because of the growth rate. How about another one? e to the minus zeta squared upon 2. Because we talked about Gaussian's e to the minus c squared upon 2. So maybe this is the appropriate complexification. Is it of exponential type? And the answer is no, because it's equal to e to the minus, let's expand this out. Zeta squared is, of course, going to be zeta is going to be c plus I eta. So minus zeta squared is going to be minus c squared minus eta squared. I'm just squaring it out. Plus O over 2 plus I two times 1/2 times I times c eta. And therefore, the size of e to the minus one half zeta squared is bounded by, well, the e to the I, see, eta doesn't contribute to the size, just the oscillation, but it's bounded by e to the, unfortunately, minus 1/2 c squared minus eta squared. And you can definitely pick rays in the eta c plane. Here's c, the real bits, and here's eta, the imaginary bits, and just sort of ignore that they're n-dimensionals for the moment, where this thing grows like a quadratic, right? In particular, take c equals 0 and eta equals, and this will grow quadratically. So is it bounded by a linear, by e, so this is e to the something times eta squared, and is that bounded by e to the r eta? Clearly not. So this is linear, that's quadratic. So this is also no. So what I'm finding is, in trying to think about other examples, maybe it's not so easy to write one down now that I've demanded it decay. But let me give a source of such exponential type functions. So let's see. Let's do the following. Given a Schwarz class function, f of x, let's do the following thing. F hat of xi is equal to 1 upon 2 pi, root 2 pi to the n, e to the minus I c dot x, f of x dx. And, of course, I want to think of this as equals a sum of terms, each of which is entire. Because here's the sum with coefficients and here are the terms. So it's a sum of functions of xi, each of which is an entire, which I said, which is, I didn't say this right, which is the real part, not the real part, the restriction to the reals, restriction to the reals of an entire function. So my first question, well, I've already had some questions, but question to you, is f hat of xi extendable the same thing? Does f hat of xi extend to an entire or even a holomorphic function? A holomorphic function. Question. So each exponential extends to a holomorphic function. Does the integral of, that's a sum of exponentials, extend to a holomorphic function? See the question? Anyone have an answer? Maybe is the answer, huh? Ooh, the silence is uncomfortable. Ooh. What do you think? I'm taking, every time I see it, so that means the following thing. Good thing to discuss then. So does this exist? F hat of zeta. Zeta is now, I'm going to try to move a little bit into the complex n space by making eta non-zero. Can I define this? E to the minus I zeta dot x. F of x dx. Can I do that? For a Schwarz class function, you can tell by my tone of voice, answer has to be no. So in general, no. Nope. Too many no's on the board, but anyways, this doesn't work. This usually doesn't work. But what's the problem is that if f... Sorry? No, not even for Schwarz class. No in general. Even for f in Schwarz class. We think those are the best functions possible. Those are a good class to work with most of the time. But it doesn't work. So let me do something slightly different is, yes, finally a yes, if f is more than in Schwarz class, f is in c naught infinity. Actually, f is in c naught, but it will be what I want if it's c naught infinity. It'll be of exponential type. So let's do that. So let's take f there and make a proposition. This is definition one. Maybe this is proposition two, which is the statement that suppose... Let me just change my notation. I'm just going to say that, I'm just going to change the name of my function. G is C naught infinity over Rn. A real or a complex valued function, right? But just but it's only defined over the reals. Sorry? Right. So this is a function of xi, and it is a sum of terms, each of which is the restriction to Rn of an entire function, because the complex exponentials are entire functions. And my question is, f is a sum of things which expand, does f itself expand? And the answer is no. And then we looked at this, and we said no in general, even for f in Schwartz class. And now we're going to say yes if we do a little bit more on f. So I'm going to say g is compact support in Rn. And I'm going to say more than that, the support of g, I want to sit inside, well, it's compact support, so it sits inside some ball. I just want to make it explicit, R. And R has to do with the same R up here. And then the answer, and then the statement I want to make is, then g hat of xi, which is what I wrote over there, 2 pi to the n integral e to the minus I xi dot x g of x dx, integrate over all Rn, extends to zeta is equal to xi plus I eta as a holomorphic function. So, and it extends to all Cn, so it's entire. I could have said it entire and saved chalk. And moreover, of exponential type. So it's a statement that you can, from the Fourier transform, you can make analytic functions. Okay. Quick question. Suppose it weren't. Is there anything? Here's a question. Vague question. Is there anything between Schwartz class and compact support? Schwartz class decays faster than any polynomial. But that does not mean it decays exponentially. So suppose I demand that the function decays exponentially. Then, in fact, the facts are that you can extend that function, that function's Fourier transform, to be holomorphic in a strip. And if it decays at rate rho, the strip is of width rho. So the faster it decays, the bigger the rho is, the wider the strip. Of course, a function of compact support decays. You can take any row because it's decaying. It's, by the time you get to R, it's already dead zero. It doesn't have to decay anymore, right? So there's a space between here. And once you're here, you're already holomorphic. You're entire. And my statement is you're of exponential type. So that's proposition one. And of course, every proposition needs its proof. So let's do the following thing. For each given zeta, we should really just try to write what the extension should be. So this is supposed to be a zeta, not a 3. This is a zeta. G of zeta is equal to 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral e to the minus I zeta dot x g of x dx. Integrate over all of Rn. But just to remind you, we could just integrate over the ball radius r about 0, because everything else is just 0 because of the support of g. And what we want to do is check the integral converges. So converges. So check 1. Converges. Integral converges. One of those, if not, that's absurd. Well, it converges. G is smooth, so therefore bounded, and you're integrating over a compact set. Two, it's holomorphic. G hat of zeta, holomorphic. So what you need is that the integral converges. Well, this integral converges for any particular zeta in the n complex plane, and it converges uniformly over compact neighborhoods of zeta. And so therefore, I can actually differentiate under the integral sign. And what I'm going to do for holomorphic things is to check the Cauchy-Riemann equations. So check Cauchy-Riemann. So what do we have to do? We have to take d by d zeta bar of g hat of zeta, which is another way of saying it's a vector differential operator, vector and complex differential operator, which has its component d by d cj plus I d by d eta j of g hat zeta. But of course, that's equal to 1 upon 2 pi. I had my little arguments why I can differentiate these two derivatives under the integral sign. So it's integral of d by d zeta bar of e to the minus I zeta dot x g of x dx. And if I've ever seen a holomorphic function, it certainly is a complex exponential. So this is equal to 0. So this is equal to 0, but that's what it means to be holomorphic. It satisfies the Cauchy-Riemann equation. But we haven't shown yet of exponential type, because we have to estimate the size of g. So let's do that. That's basically an argument why it's entire. So now, lastly, estimate. So I need to look at g hat of zeta, and then I actually want to multiply it by zeta to powers. So zeta is some power, n. And I know zeta is a multiple complex variable. So so n should be, n is not an integer, it's a multi-index. But just bide with me. N over here is not a multi-index, so is anyone bothered by that notation? All right. Zeta to the beta, where zeta to the beta is, of course, zeta 1 to the beta 1, zeta n to the beta n. And size of beta equals n. Okay, that's equal to what? zeta to the beta integral. And I'll put my two pi's over here so I don't have to worry about them. Integral. E to the minus I zeta dot x g of x dx. And that's equal to integral. I d by dx to the beta e to the minus I zeta dot x g of x dx, right, is equal to, by integrations by parts, e to the minus I zeta x times 1 upon I partial x to the beta g of x dx. A dot here, a dot there. And now this is terrible. And now I'm going to do something which is horrible for people who take notes, which is I'm going to put absolute values in all my things. Absolute value, because I need to know how big this grows. Because to be of exponential type, I have to bound this thing. And so I need to know if I can bound powers of zeta against g hat. So I take that and I multiply absolute value of this, absolute value of this, absolute value of this inside. Why not? And I note that this, I'm allowed to integrate always over b, the ball radius r. And so it seems to me that the integral over the ball of radius r of derivatives of g is bounded. Well, g is a complex, is a C0 infinity function, so it's bounded by one of the seminorms of g. So this is going to be bounded by The soup, so soup over the ball of radius r about 0, this is x in the ball of radius r about 0, of e to the minus I zeta dot x times, well, the integral of the ball radius r about 0, this the best we can do for dx beta g, dx. And this thing is a bounded number bounded by some seminorm, bounded by some seminorm of g. It's a bounded number. And we need to know, how big does this get? So I guess let's look at that. Well, I guess you already have it, but just the trivial thing, but it's the last thing. So last thing, which is soup, when you are taking x over the ball of radius r, about 0, of the size of e to the minus I zeta dot x, surely bounded by e to the biggest that zeta dot x can be. Oh, hang on a minute. I take that back. It's bounded by soup x in the ball of radius r about 0. This is e to the minus I c dot x times e to the minus I times I eta, so e to the plus eta dot x. And this has size 1. The xi doesn't matter, but the eta does. So this is equal to e to the soup over x in the ball of radius r about 0, the size of eta dot x. And eta is the imaginary part of xi. And so the biggest this can get is, well, something how big eta can get, which is in the estimate, and how big can c get, can x get? The biggest they can get is r. So this is less than or equal to e to the r size of eta. And just remember that eta, size of eta, is equal to the size of the imaginary part of zeta. That's what eta is. So what we've done is shown that such a thing is of exponential type. Okay, that's an interesting discussion, but maybe not so, but relatively elementary. Why absolute value of eta dot x? Because the size of this is the size of this, and this is always 1. So the soup of e to the eta dot x, this is real, is the e to the soup of eta dot x. E is a continuous function. I could do that. He wants me to put parentheses here. Yeah, because it goes negative, it goes positive, but you're taking the biggest it can get. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
The trouble with the general Schwarzschild function is that that integral might not converge.
Absolutely it. It's going to decay, so that's a good question. F, where is a good example? Here we are. F is decaying faster than any polynomial as x gets large real, but e to the minus I zeta dot x has a real component, and it could be e to the eta times x, which gets exponentially big, the size of eta, and that could grow faster than this decays. So this could be infinity. Well, it needs to be well-defined over a neighborhood, right? I need to be able to differentiate. At one point, it probably doesn't count. Just by some happenstance, it might converge at one point, but the neighborhood, it doesn't. I would worry a little bit, okay? Well, what's nice about this is not this tiny little proposition, which I've just proved, but the converse is true. So that's the context of Pelliwenia theory. It says the converse holds as well. So that's kind of nice. I'm going to, it seems a little disrespectful to squeeze Paley-Wiener's great theorem in such a small corner, but if I leave it there, I'll move to a proof on the big blackboard. So, in fact, it does seem disrespectful. I'll move the whole thing over here. So this is theorem 3. It's our third thing today, which is really the core of Paley-Wiener theory, which says, suppose that we showed up on the Fourier side and had a G of zeta. Suppose G of zeta is an entire function I let the hat off just to not prejudice ourselves, an entire function of exponential type. And not only that, I want it to have an exponential type R. Then, the statement is, then there is an F of X, and that F of X is in C naught infinity of Rn, such that it has with support F in the ball radius R about zero, such that G of zeta is equal to F hat, function of zeta, which is the extension, as we talked about. You take F, you take its F hat, its function of C, you extend it to complex n dimensions. So it's 1 upon root 2 pi to the n integral e to the minus I zeta dot x F of x dx. Interesting. Interesting. So let's see what we can do. So we have to now prove this. We have to prove this, and I guess we need a target F to begin with. Is everyone with me what we're doing at least? We need a target F to begin with. So it's pretty straightforward to define F. So first of all, F should be. So this mythical F of X should be, and it's going to be, I just have to show it, as I have to watch out for its properties. 1 upon 2 pi root n, integral over Rn, I want to integrate over the xi's. G is defined everywhere, but I'm only going to integrate over the real hyperplane, dxc, e to the I, c dot x. And this is integrate over Rnx, so this is for xi in Rn. Remember, zeta is equal to xi plus I eta in cn. Excuse me. Too much chalk. Must be hard on the microphone. And then, what do we know about g? Since we have that zeta, excuse me, as soon as we have zeta, what is it, 1 plus zeta to the nth power g of zeta, and we know that this is bounded. Let's see, c n e to the r imaginary part of zeta, clearly 1 plus c to the n g at c plus I0, c to the n. Oh, boy. Too much chalk dust. And therefore, this decays well. And so this integrand converges perfectly nicely. So I don't have to worry about the existence of f on the real axis. So, at least it's a function, and it's well-defined. Secondly, it's smooth. Because my assertion is that f is c0 infinity, so I'm going to show c infinity first. So it has derivatives. So we can take an arbitrary number of derivatives. We can also take arbitrary derivatives. So I'm going to do that. Let's say d by dx, let's see, I called it alpha in my notes, d by dx alpha of s equals 1 over 2 pi n upon 2 integral rnc. And I take derivatives, and I can, and this is the case well, so I can differentiate inside. Here's where the x occurs. Every time I get an x, I get down an ixc. So it's, of course, going to be ixc to the power alpha, e to the ixc dot x, g of c dxc. But ixc, g still decays rapidly for any finite alpha. So therefore, we conclude f is c infinity as a function of x. So the question is it over its support? This is all easy stuff, and we've already done it a couple times before. The question is over its support. So consider the further integrals. So consider not quite this integral, but another integral. I want to do the following thing. 1 upon root 2 pi to the n, always this annoying factor. Some people set 2 pi equals 1. I mean, some states in the United States have set 2 pi equals 1, just or 22... What is it? Pi equal 22/7, just to avoid annoyance. But this is a different impulse. If we set 2 pi equals 1, then we don't have to write this constant all the time. Although, usually, you know, we know better. But I guess I won't. So consider further integrals. The annoyance factor times e to the I something or other times g of xi, I want to write. I better put the something or other in. I don't want just a c anymore, because I'm just going to move in one direction off the real axis. So I'm going to say c1 plus I eta 1, and I'm going to multiply that by x1 plus the rest. So plus c prime dot x prime, where c prime and x prime are the rest of the other variables, right? C prime is equal to C2 up to Cn, and X prime is equal to X2 up to Xn. So I just move in eta a little bit, but eta's fixed finite amount. Eta fixed the finite amount, and then I integrate again in Xi. So G of, as a function of Xi, I want it to be C1 plus I eta 1, and then C prime. D Xi. All of Xi's, dc. And my claim is that this is equal to, this is equal to if I didn't make eta 1. So my claim is independent of eta 1. And so I'm allowed to take one of the Xs. I remember I'm doing all integrating over all the real parts, but I just move it up a little bit into the imaginary direction in the C1 eta 1 plane, and it doesn't change its value. How am I going to do that? Whose theorem? Cauchy's theorem. So let's just write it. It's like a change of variables formula, but it's a complex version. Here's C1, here's eta 1, here's my, I have some colored chalk, so it's kind of nice, nice red path of integration. Here's my initial path of integration over all the C1s and all the rest of the Xs for that matter. So it's a plane of integration. But then I move up, but to some eta, some value of eta 1, and I do this contour integral. And then I take the limit as this goes to infinity, and this goes to minus infinity. And this integral plus this plus this plus that is zero by complex variables in the eighth, in the zeta one complex variable. And so there, and this being holomorphic means it's holomorphic in that variable alone, as well as doing other things. And so the claim is true. Just move it into the eta. Oh, and what counts is what happens to these edges. But for fixed eta, the size of G in C getting large decays. So those edges go to zero when you take the limit. Okay, so well, now that I can move one edge at a time, I can move them all. So in particular, so you do the same argument in all variables. So now do them all. And you find that f of x, which is this integral, is also equal to the 1 upon 2 pi root n integral over c n. You can do the following thing. E to the I, originally it's e to the I c dot x, g of c d c, but you can really do the following thing. You can add c plus any plus I eta, plus any I eta dot x, and then you just change g to c plus I eta d c, but then the eta is a fixed number in there. Fixed n, real n vector in there, the imaginary part. And you don't change the value, so it's always f. Okay? That's what it's calling to do. So, that's good. Yes?
It's not clear why you can throw this integral forward at n, because although the function is decaying, the exponential might be growing.
Yeah, that's very good. But this says the exponential grows in the imaginary part of C. So if the imaginary part is bounded by 10, then this decays as C gets large, but the imaginary part's only 10. So here, I've made a special slab, the slab in particular, so the imaginary part's bounded by the size of eta 1, which is maybe 10. So these have C going to infinity and eta 1 bounded. So that bound, the exponential part does not kick in. It's only the polynomial decay part which does that. You could do it with only a little polynomial decay. I put it all in just for C infinityness. Okay? And now let's see how big F is. So let's fix X not equal to 0. X and Rn, of course. Remember. And I want to choose a particular eta. Choose a particular eta. Remember, I'm allowed any eta, and I don't get any, for any fixed eta, I don't get a change in the answer. Right? So I'm going to choose a particular eta, and I want it to be equal to something to do with x. And let's, in fact, just say it's lambda times the x direction. So this is the unit vector in the x direction that's on the unit sphere in n dimensions. And lambda I'm going to use to make it large. Lambda's real. Lambda's r plus. Then let's see how big f is. F of x is less than or equal to the nuisance factor, root 2 pi to the n. Absolute value of the integral over rn. E to the something. E to the I c dot x. Then the imaginary part, e to the minus eta dot x. So e to the minus eta dot x. But eta is special. Eta dot x is lambda 1 over x times x. So it is minus eta dot x gives me a minus lambda x. So I get x dot x is x squared divided by x. I get x, size of x. Okay, times, this is all the exponent, times g of c plus I lambda x over x dxc, right? Close absolute value. Less than or equal to nuisance factor. Integral over Rn, still integrating over c. E to the minus lambda x. That's bringing out the real part of the exponent. Times absolute value of e to the ix c dot x. That's 1. Times absolute value of g of c plus I lambda over x dc. Less than or equal to 1 over root 2 pi to the n integral rn c e to the minus lambda size of x. How big can g get? How big can g get? Well, it has this factor. Oh, sorry, I put this underneath. It has this factor, and this factor. So cn, sum cn, sum 1 upon the size of zeta, but I'll just have it the size of c. So 1 plus c to the n. That's a smaller number in the denominator, so a bigger number. Then the fact I'm not even using all the weight. Times, what's the exponential? E to the imaginary, r times the imaginary part. What's the imaginary part? Lambda x over x. E to the r lambda. Dc. All this comes from this and that estimate in the definition. Okay? So, this integral in particular is finite over c. The integral in c is finite. So it's less than some other constant, cn, I don't know, prime, which has to do with the nuisance factor and this integral over c, and I'm left with e to the minus lambda plus r whole thing times x. Whoops. No, that's not right. E to the minus lambda times, well, it's what e to the lambda r minus x. That's what I want. And I take lambda large and positive. Well, if x is small, I have nothing to say. But if x is bigger than r, the negative part in the exponent is bigger than the positive part of the exponent. This has to hold for all lambda. What do you conclude? F of x is smaller than this number for any lambda. That is, it's zero. If x is less than r, greater than r, this implies that f of x equals zero. And it's compact support. That is, support of f is in the ball radius r, about zero. There we have Paley-Wiener's principle theorem. Very good. Questions? Yeah. Right. 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 So it's a good thing I proved this piece of the blackboard, which says the values of f do not change as I move my hypersurface of integration. I'm integrating over an n-dimensional space, but that's a hypersurface in Cn. And I move that into the complex by eta. The values of f don't change. And I just, in the last board, I choose the direction of eta, which is going to be useful to show that, in fact, this estimate. Okay? That's what that thing is for. That's Cauchy's theorem. You might say it's a complex change of variables. You think Cauchy's theorem, the version of it, is complex change of variables. I already did it once for you, and I sort of snuck it in when I computed the Gaussian. You remember that? Some people remember. Okay, so here's a question for you. Question. And it's based on this, which is, I put down the exponential, and then it didn't really quite fit the estimate because of this power law, this rapid decay. So what I want to do is actually make the same statement for distributions of compact support. So I want, what I want you to think about, if you really want, I'll make a homework set over it, but all I want you to do is think about is, if G of zeta simply behaves E to the R imaginary part of zeta, then G is equal to F hat, where F is a distribution. What did we say the distributions were? D prime, but a distribution of compact support. So E prime with support of F in the ball radius R about zero in X. This is an X space. So the distributional version, which I don't ask for the derivatives. But then everything in the process had to have interpreted in the distributional sense. In particular, I couldn't take all the derivatives and show something C infinity. I'd have to do that on the test function of the differential. So it works. I just want you to think it through. Okay? You can take distributions. You can take entire functions of exponential type. You can even allow, here I demand polynomial decay, faster than polynomial decay in real directions. You can even allow polynomial growth in the real directions, and you'll get, but this will give you the control of the behavior in the imaginary direction, will give you compact support of the Fourier transform. Very nice. Let's return to the wave equation. Where is the wave equation in all this? We've just been doing complex variables. I mean, it's good for mathematical culture in any case, but we really would like to stick a little closer to the material. So, way back to the wave equation. It goes as follows. I have, let's see, what is it? Partial t squared u minus Laplacian u. Laplacian with respect to x, u equals 0. And I want u of x when t is equal to 0 is some initial position f of x. And the ut of x, 0 is some initial momentum g of x. And we know what we wrote down the solution using the Fourier transform. We also, in one dimension, wrote down the solution using something or other else. But here, let's do the Fourier transform one. Let's represent our solution using the Fourier transform. And if I remember right, actually, I'm happy I have my notes, the Knudsen's factor, 2 pi to the n, times e to the I c dot x, times two terms, a cosine of mod c t, f hat of c, plus a sine term, mod c t over c, g hat of c, d c. Let's suppose the initial data has compact support. Let's do that. So let's suppose it's always a good idea. Here's t. Here's x. It's always a good idea, at least for one's imagination. Here's x1. Here are the rest of the x's, say x2. It's always a good idea to think, what happens if I put data in here, in the ball of radius r about 0? What happens with that data? So suppose f of x and g of x have their support in the ball of radius r about 0. What happens? Well, let's do this line of reasoning, because I've set us up for that. Then, f hat of xi g hat of c extend to f hat of zeta, g hat of zeta, which are entire, well, entire of exponential type. That's not quite right, because I haven't said where f and g are. But let me cure that glitch by saying that these are c not infinity of Rn in x. I didn't really want to say that they're smooth, but let's pretend they're smooth anyway. It's a weaker theorem, but it goes more generously. If you do this thought exercise about distributions of compact support, you could put in F and G distributions, and we'll get the same result. Then F hat and G hat are exponential type, and now I have to look at what's the Fourier transform of U look like? What is this object? So I want to make the notice, I want us to observe, that's a good word, observe, that if F hat is entire of exponential type, and you multiply by cosine of mod CT, so I need something about cosine. Cosine of zeta, how do I want to do this? I want to do the following thing. I want the zeta squared square root of t. And I want to look at, I want to look at sine zeta squared t over square root of zeta squared. And I want to see how big these are. This will be the same thing. This will be not bigger than e to the imaginary part of zeta times t. Absolute value, imaginary part of zeta times t. That, the same one, same thing. I have to make a little note saying, what is this zeta squared square root business? But I want the zeta, of course, is C plus C1 plus I eta 1, C2 plus I eta 2, etc. And so what I want the zeta squared is equal to, C1 plus I eta 1 squared, not the absolute value, right? I want the complex square, etc. And then I want its square root to be the complex square root of the sum. So let's, I want this to be plus, that's what I want it to be, plus C2 plus I eta 2 squared plus. And then the square root of zeta squared is equal to the square root of this thing. And that's not so great, it has to have a branch cut, but the cosine of it doesn't. And the sine of it doesn't if you also divide by this. And that's what you're supposed to remember from ODE theory, which is cosine of CT, right? Let's see, how do you say that? Cosine of CT is a function of C squared. Maybe we should say cosine of AT is a function of A squared. Just think of its Taylor expansion. Sine of AT is A times a function of A squared, and if you divide by that A, it's a function of A squared. And that square root goes away, and now it's a function of zeta squared, which is a good holomorphic function of zeta, and it behaves, it's holomorphic, and it behaves this estimate. Or else write it out in terms of its exponentials. Anyway, something to note. That's what I want you to note. Using it, cosine of root zeta squared t, f hat of zeta, plus sine of root zeta squared t over root zeta squared g hat of zeta is now of exponential type also. Because I can't ruin the exponential type of f hat and g hat by multiplying by something which only grows linearly in the exponent. But it doesn't have the same constant. It's of exponential type. So this is of exponential type. But which constant? You get an r from f and g, but you get a t from multiplying from by the sine and cosine. And now go back to Paley-Wiener theory, or use Paley-Wiener theory. And it says, where's the support of u? Where's the state of my theorem? Where's my theorem? It's hidden. Where's the support of u? In the ball radius r plus t. So support of u is inside the ball, support of u of x, t. And what I mean is the x support of u is in ball radius r plus modulus of t, about zero. Which is to say, in this picture, that you follow the characteristics out at speed one, and you make a bigger ball. And now this is r, so this is r plus t, if this is t. And that's finite propagation speed. So, theorem. Theorem. And I think it's the theorem 4, which is finite propagation speed. It says the following. Finite propagation speed for the wave equation. Solutions of our equation. I'm not sure if you have an equation number. Solutions of box u equals zero with starting with compactly supported initial data. So the support F, say union support, that's the way of saying it, support G being in the ball of radius R about zero, satisfy the support of U of XT for T fixed. The support of U XT is in the ball BR plus modulus of T. About zero. Isn't that interesting? What I want to prove. Well, now I want to draw pictures. So this is one picture I wanted to draw, which is you put in data here, the solution is identically zero outside. But inside, it can be non-zero, but and that region grows, but it grows only at the speed of light. It can't grow faster. And that's sometimes known as the weak Huygens principle. So this picture is sometimes known as the weak Huygens principle. Right. So let's see. Just to do this, and I talked about this last week, of course, but I'll just say it again. You have an observer. Suppose you put an observer here. This is at x naught, and x naught is bigger than t, greater than r, so the solution is zero for a while. You have to wait for a while until the sonic boom hits that person's stationary prime, like, you know, your world line, his path, and then he hears it. He or she hears it. And then you're inside and you can carry on hearing it, maybe. Okay, so you don't see the solution until the first characteristic from the support of the data hits you. Okay? Well, because I had two principles last time. Because when we solved using the D'Alembert formula exactly in one dimension, we found two principles. One was exactly this. If you were outside the region of support of the data, you didn't hear the solution until the data propagated along a characteristic to hit you. But in one dimension, and in all odd dimensions, once the support of the data passed you, the solution was zero, or in one dimension, constant. That's the strong principle, that inside the light cone, the solution vanishes as well. The weak is outside the light cone. You take the union of light cone supported over your data, that's my next statement, then the solution is zero outside. That's the weak maximum principle. Okay, so I want to say that in a corollary. What I just said is corollary 5. Which is, if F, G, R, if they do the following thing, if F and G vanish, let's do the opposite thing. On the ball radius R about zero, then the solution U of XT vanishes in a cone. The following thing, X less than R minus T. Well, for 0 less than T less than R. And the proof is as follows. The picture is as follows, and that picture is going to be the proof. X1, X, all the other X ends, X2, here's T. Here's a big ball in which, now I'm going to say the opposite. I want F and G to be exactly zero inside there. Could be non-zero out here. Well, you draw the cone. This cone C, which I'm drawing, is the cone above this. That's what I drew. It's inside there. And, of course, data anywhere outside. Let me try to put some data in. I can put some data in here, of course, it can be supported in this cone, in this region. But, of course, it can't travel too fast, and it can't penetrate here. So that's the statement of the corollary. Right? U has to be zero in here. If F and G are zero, then U has to be zero here, identically zero. And this is a uniqueness theorem. Saying that if you have initial data, start out with zero initial data, at least in some region, then the solution has to be zero in a slightly smaller region of space, smaller as time, that progressively smaller as time goes on. Okay? And then I want to just finish this section of the hour. I mean, now it's hour and a quarter, by saying I'm going to leave this up. I'll start eliminating from over here. So I want to make a definition, and that's definition 5, and that is has two bits. One is the domain of influence of a set A in R and X. So it is the following thing. It is the region in Rn plus 1, that is an X and T space, in which a solution UXT of the wave equation. With data supported in A, it's a region in which a solution can be non-zero when data is supported in A. So my grammar has me putting can be non-zero. Grammar got a little dramatic there. And then 2 is the domain of, I'm defining the domain of influence. Of course, 2 is the domain of dependence. Domain of dependence of a set B in R n plus 1 in space-time is the region A in Rn of X of data, which, I'll say it this way, which can influence the solution in the set B. So I would just want to finish this hour by the 2 pictures of what the first one is, what the second one is. So here's space-time, x1, x prime, all the others, t, and I'll give some set A. So this is A. And of course, over every point in A, I draw a light cone. And that's where data at that point in A can be sent by our solution process, by any solution process, but in particular by this solution process, given our theory of propagation. But of course, other points have other cones. That's not a very good cone, but and here's a cone. And you take the union of all these cones, and you'll get so you get a region over this set A. So this is the set A, and then you get a region over the set A, which is expanding basically in T, and that's what you can influence by putting data in the set A. Similarly, if you look at space-time, x1, x prime, t, and let's just make B one point, then you can have the solution at B influenced by this set. So this is going to be the domain of influence, domain of dependence. The solution at B only depends on A. It doesn't depend on data anywhere else. Good. High time we had a small break, at least for the instructor's sake. I want to move on to the Schrodinger equation. So this is 2.6. So in its simplest form, it looks like this. I d by dt of c is equal to 1/2 Laplacian with respect to x of c. And generally, well, its simplest form, so I'm allowed to do this. I want x in n dimensions, and it's typically an initial value problem. So I want, when t is equal to 0, I want to have that as given data. Now, it's a little hard for me to imagine that we can figure out, you know, fool around and set data for quantum mechanics. But maybe somehow you know it a priori and want to make a prediction. Happy. But then we have to discuss various views on measurement theory. And by your statement, I'm seeing you are a solid Copenhagen type. So let's not step on controversial territory, and you only get deltas in any case. Take a measurement, and I want to say that of course there's an I in the equation. D by dt is a real operator, and Laplacian is a real operator, but there's an I, and so we're going to need c of xt. No matter what we start with initial data, this will generally be a complex number, and it's called, at least in the business, called the wave function, or the quantum wave function. And good. And actually, this could be some people. I have to ask the experts in the audience. Sometimes it's called the complex probability amplitude. It's not a probability distribution, but it is something which might give you a probability. Does that say probability? Probability amplitude? Complex probability amplitude? Quantum wave function or complex probability amplitude? Okay, and what I want to do, of course, keeping with the theme of this section, is solve using Fourier transform. So let's see, I will take c hat, a function of c and t. It's the Fourier transform of c. Again, it's a function of c and t. Excuse my redundancy. 1 upon 2 pi to the n, root 2 pi to the n, the nuisance factor I've been calling it. E to the minus I c dot x, c of x dx, and put it in the equation. So ask to satisfy. Let's put it in the equation. So I'm only taking the Fourier transform in x, so t stays t, of course. So I d by dt c dot, what you could say is the Fourier transform commutes with the time derivative. I'm getting more dust. This is a very, very dusty day somehow. Equal to, but now I have to take the Fourier transform of Laplacian, now we're experts, and we get from plus Laplacian, we get minus c squared c hat of c and t. And of course, we want to start with c hat c originally as the Fourier transform of the initial data. And of course, doing this, we can now solve. So you solve, so the solution, of course, is going to be c hat of c t is equal to e to the I c squared upon 2 t c hat of 0, which is c 0 of c. and therefore you try to recover, and then we recover our solution by taking the inverse Fourier transform. So C of x t is equal to nuisance factor root 2 pi to the n integral e to the I c dot x times this quantity e to the I c squared over 2 t c naught hat c dc. And just to complete the sentence, it's 1 over 2 pi to the n double integral e to the I c dot x minus y e to the I c squared t over 2 c naught of y dx. That's just what we did with the heat equation. And so I want to evaluate an integral for you. So that's maybe lemma one. Evaluation of a complex Gaussian integral. So if I were to interchange integrations, I would come out with the Schrodinger kernel, S of x, y, and t, and I guess I can guarantee it's going to be a function of S, x minus y, equal the following thing. And I want you to, it'd be useful to integrate the interchange of the integrations in your mind and just see what you get. It's going to be 1 upon 2 pi to the n, that factor, times the integral. If I interchange the integrations, then the dy is afterwards, and the c naught of y is outside. So I'll just put everything else inside. E to the I c dot x minus y, e to the I c squared t over 2 dx. Good. And the statement is that this is equal to 1 upon root 2 pi I t to the n e to the minus I c x minus y squared over 2 t. Anyone have any comments? I have a question, which is 2 pi I t. So one comment is this integral doesn't really converge very well, does it? In particular, it doesn't converge absolutely. If I take the absolute value of the integrand, what do I get? 1. And then I integrate over all of Rn and C, and I get infinity. So it's an oscillatory integral, and you have to make sense of it. Nonetheless, there's a certain amount of sense in this. So problem set 7. Is that what we're on? Problem set 8. Is prove this formula. Part of the proof is make sense of this formula. Okay? So prove this formula including a sense in which one interprets the oscillatory integral. Very good. Thank you. So, but in any case, we have derived a solution representation for the Schrodinger equation. So that gives us a formula 2. So a solution representation including the Schrodinger kernel. So we have derived the following solution representation. That's 2 C of x t equals integral over Rn 1 upon root 2 pi I t to the nth power e to the minus I x minus y squared upon 2 t c naught of y dy. And now on this integral, I agree that the absolute value of this thing, this is absolute value 1, and this has absolute value essentially 1 upon 2 pi t to the n. So, okay, this is only 1, but the convergence of the integral is based on what happens with c naught. But here, it's not. So there's a better, still maybe a problem, but it's better. Okay? And we want to call this equal to integral over Rn, s of x minus y, t, c naught of y, dy. And it's similar to their, so s is the Schrodinger kernel, and it's this is similar to the solution of the heat equation, but for that annoying I. And one have to really, really, really think about it in a number of cases. And I'd like to say that maybe in its bigger incarnation, the Schrodinger equation is a wave equation. Well, the heat equation is a diffusion equation. And the heat equation has a well-defined arrow of time. You have to go forward. You can't go back, well, without dire, generally dire consequences. But the Schrodinger equation, forward and back, is immaterial. It's a reversible equation, like all good physics. And the arrow of time has to be decided upon by you or for other reasons. Okay? We're getting to that. You're jumping ahead of me. So it's always nice to have people jump ahead of you. But, yep. So in particular, if I take the heat kernel just as a function of x and t, and I take t greater than 0, this thing is in Schwarz class and better. So for all t, you know, it decays very rapidly as x goes to infinity, and all sorts of integrals with respect to the heat kernel converge because there's not very much heat coming at you from infinity. But s of xt, on the other hand, is it's always in C infinity, which is kind of nice. But what happens to that decay as x gets large for positive t? What happens to the decay as x gets large? This is not decay. It's oscillation. So this has decay at x large, and this has oscillation at x large. And oscillation is always more subtle than decay. So I have... that theorem to say that the theorem, and let's see, this is a lemma 1, so theorem 2. Which is 1, two parts, 1 for initial data, C naught in Schwarz class, the solution, which is given by formula 2, the solution C of x t in 2, converges absolutely. So it's an integral. And in fact, C of xt itself is in Schwarz class. I mean, what I mean by that, this is Schwarz class of functions in x. So this is Schwarz class in functions in x. Consider t as a parameter. Sometimes it's good to consider t as a parameter, sometimes not. T is a parameter here. Okay? Part 2 of theorem. I need a bigger piece of chalk. Part 2 of the theorem is for it. So there's the two natural settings, I think, for the Schrodinger equation. probably the most natural is L2, and the second most natural maybe is Schwarz class. So let's talk about L2. For initial data, C naught in L2 of Rn, then the integral in formula 2 converges in L2 sense, and for all t, so for all times, the solution C of xt is an L2 of Rn. That is, again, fixed time, it take a x slice, that's an L2 function of Rn. Okay? Proof. Proof, the strategy is I'm going to prove theorem part 1 by an estimate and part 2 by reducto ad absurdum. So define, so let's see, define C of xt, of course, it's equal to the S of x minus y t C naught of y dy. And we can see that, I guess we can do it this way. It's really the inverse Fourier transform of e to the I c squared t upon 2 c naught hat of c. And this is in Schwarz class, because C naught was in Schwarz class, so its Fourier transform is in Schwarz class. And then if I take a function in Schwarz class and I multiply it by this smooth function, which is bounded, whose derivatives only grow polynomially, then I guess the result is Schwarz class. So a moment's reflection says this is also in Schwarz class. And then it's the inverse Fourier transform of something which is Schwarz class, so it's in Schwarz class. No. F has something in it. I agree. Script F has something in it. But let's see. Let me just prove that to you here. But if I need it, you can put it in. But I don't think I need it this time. Okay. So let's do 2 by the reductor. So that's proof for 1. So let's do 2. Well, it was finally my chance to say the joke again and have it in its true setting, which is you know, the physicist reducto ad absurdum. Suppose not. That's absurd. Well, that's the case here. Maybe I should have said the joke second, because I actually want to give a real proof, and then I'll give the joke again. Ah, terrible timing. So the solution formula gives us the following thing. I have to look at C of xt, and I'm supposed to measure its L2 norm. And it's easier to measure its L2 norm squared, saves writing square roots. So, of course, by Poincaré, that is C of xt, but also I can measure it by taking c hat of xt, c hat of xt, hard to say, squared, dxc, integrate over all of Rn, Rn c this time. And of course I know what that is, it's Rn c, that is absolute value of e to the I c squared t over 2, except if Doug had his way, I would have to put some 2 pi's in, but I don't think I do, c hat 0 of c squared dxc, but this has unit length. So I'll just put extra absolute values there, and then this is just 1. So it's equal to c naught hat c squared dxc, which is, by Poincaré in reverse, c naught squared L2, with a hat and then without a hat. And so that proves, well, at least it proves that the result is L2, but you can see that you're taking the inverse Fourier transform of something which is just a product. So that will actually do. And the fact is, in here, these are equalities, not inequalities. These are equalities because of the Poincaré theorem. And so it's more than it's L2. In fact, the solution has C of xt preserves, what should I say, is the map t to C of xt preserves. That's not right. The solution map, how do I want to say that? The flow, capital phi of t starting at C naught, which is equal to C of xt, preserves the L2 norm. And this has an interpretation in quantum, and it's related, very closely related to interpretation of quantum mechanics. So I want to give that interpretation of quantum mechanics. Oh. So let's see. So that does the following thing. So quantum mechanics says, so it states, that the wave function has certain meaning. So it says you take C of xt and you take its absolute value. It's a complex number, so you take its absolute value squared, dx. And it says, and Bohr, or I'm not sure who said it first, maybe Max Born, I'm told, says that this is actually a probability measure. So dpt of x, probability measure. Well, in fact, it's a linear equation, and it could have any total integral. So what we should say is normalize the initial data. I mean, in a linear equation, sorry, normalize the initial data, C naught of x. In a linear equation, you can always multiply a solution by 10, and it's still a solution. So multiply this solution, this data, by a number so that this is equal to 1, basically divide by its norm. Or if it's not zero solution, divide by its norm. And then this is a probability measure. And what we've just... So, and this is the probability measure resulting from an initial distribution of a quantum particle of a particle being C naught of x squared dx, which is equal going to be my dp0 of x. And and let's see, so the interpretation has it, so you interpret the probability of, let's see, I want to say this right, so the probability of, so what I want to say is the probability that our quantum particle is in a set, I guess I need a measurable set, A in Rn at time t is integral over the set A of dpt of x, which is integral over A, absolute value C of xt squared dx. And we could say that this is the probability that it's in A. And if I have normalized rightly, then the probability that it's somewhere is equal to 1. Well, let's just check that. That's the integral over everything. C of x t squared dx. And if we normalize initially to be right, then it's preserved. That's step preservation. Now back to our proof of 2, reductible by ad absurdum. You can't lose probability. So very fundamentally in the consistency of this interpretation is the fact that the square of the wave function, the total integral of the square of the wave function is preserved. You should have set it to 1 initially, I guess at least in the setting I'm giving it, and it stays 1. And you're looking at dynamics, and so your dynamics is flow on the unit ball in Hilbert space, because you're always preserving unit length 1. Okay, and so statement 2, just along with that, is Schrodinger's equation, just to emphasize it, Schrodinger's equation preserves probability. There are other conservation laws as well. I'm running out of time, but I want to talk about those at least a bit. So, yep, getting to it, but I wasn't even going to say that first. I was moving. I was going to say some other things. So, for example, there's kinetic energy. So, in particular, let's see, that kinetic energy, I'll call it E of C, is equal, actually, this is also the total energy in this case, is, I probably should say, the energy is preserved, and this is the kinetic energy. Energy, total energy. But in the equation I wrote down here, there's no potential energy. We're really, I guess you could say we're in the vacuum. So this actually, what I'm writing down is the kinetic energy. And then the just potential energy is just 0. And this can be understood again nicely by the Fourier transform. So let's try it. So E of C is equal to integral over Rn, grad c squared dx is equal to half, I forgot the half, is equal to integral of Rn, always 1/2. But by the Poincaré theorem, this is a sum of L2 vectors, if it's finite, having to do with all the different components of the gradient. And so this is a sum of L2 vectors, which has to do with C times C hat of C mod squared dxc. That's Poincaré theorem, which is equal to 1/2 integral over Rn C. But of course we know what C hat is. Oh, this is a T, because this is evolving in time. So we know what C hat is. It's E to the I C squared T upon 2 C 0 hat C squared big C. And now you look at this absolute value, just does not see those rapid, even those highly rapid, very rapid changes of phase. So this is equal to 1/2 Rn C, C naught hat C squared dx. This doesn't depend on time, which is the energy of the initial data. So there's a pretty easy proof of conservation of energy just by doing that. And I'm wondering how many minutes more you have patience for. But let's at least try to get the basics in. So here's a proposition, and I have how many? Lemma 1 or 2, proposition 3, which is, I want to state this fact first, solutions of our Schrodinger equation conserve energy. That's statement 1 I want to make. In fact, They conserve lots of other things. In fact, they conserve infinitely many other conserved quantities. There are infinitely many other conserved quantities, and I want to give you the family. They conserve the following integral. Integral of m of d c of xt squared dx, I'll say it this way, it's equal to the same as m of d c0 of x squared dx. This is always integral over Rn in x for any Fourier multiplier operator. M of d. Now, do you remember what the Fourier multiplier was? I talked about those when we were talking about the Green's function on the upper half space and such things. Well, let me just remind you that m of d. Well, one thing is I take 1 upon I d by dx f, and I take a hat of it. Well, let me say it this way. This is a function of x, but I can write it as c f hat of c, and then inverse Fourier transform. And it was convenient, and so we didn't have to write all the i's and stuff. This is d of f. It's convenient to write d of f. But then it says I can have a Fourier multiplier operator. Now, this is going to be by definition. By definition,